This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Fix, written by David Baldacci, read by Keith Brewer and Orla Cassidy. To Jamie Robb, a great publisher and a wonderful friend, may your future endeavors be filled with both fun and success. Thank you for all your support the past 20 years. I will always be your biggest fan. Chapter 1. It was normally one of the safest places on Earth, but not today. The J. Edgar Hoover Building was the world headquarters of the FBI. It opened in 1975 and had not aged well. A blocks-long chunk of badly dilapidated concrete with honeycomb windows and fire alarms and toilets that didn't work. There was even safety netting strung around the top of the building to catch chunks of crumbling concrete before they could fall to the street below and kill someone. The Bureau was trying to build a new facility to house 11,000 employees, but a new location hadn't even been chosen. So the opening of a new headquarters was about $2 billion and 7 years away. For now, this was home. The tall man striding down the tree-lined sidewalk was Walter Dabney. He had taken an Uber to a coffee shop down the street, ordered some food, and was now walking the rest of the way. He was in his 60s, with thinning salt-and-pepper hair parted on the side. It looked recently cut, with a bit of cowlick in the back. His suit was expensive and fit his portly frame with the touch of a tailored hand. A colorful pocket square adorned the front of his dark suit. He wore a lanyard around his neck, loaded with clearances sufficient to allow him access into the inner sanctums of the Hoover Building, with an escort along for the ride. His green eyes were alert. He walked with a determined swagger, his briefcase making pendulum arcs in the air. A woman was coming from the opposite direction. Anne Berkshire had taken the metro here. She was in her late 50s, petite, with gray hair cut in parentheses around her long oval face. As she approached the Hoover Building, she seemed to hesitate. There was no lanyard around her neck. The only ID she possessed was the driver's license in her purse. It was late morning, and the streets were not as crowded as they would have been earlier. Still, there were a great many pedestrians, and the street hummed with activity as cars passed up and down, with some vehicles making their way into an underground parking garage at the Hoover Building. Dabney picked up his pace a bit, his Allen Edmonds wingtips striking the stained pavement with purpose. He started to whistle a cheery tune. The man seemed not to have a care in the world. Berkshire was now walking faster, too. Her gaze went to the left and then swung right. She seemed to take in everything with that one sweeping glance. About 20 yards behind Dabney, Amos Decker trudged along alone. He was 6'5" and built like the football player he had once been. He'd been on a diet for several months now and had dropped a chunk of weight, but he could stand to lose quite a bit more. He was dressed in khaki pants, stained at the cuff, and a long, rumpled Ohio State Buckeyes pullover that concealed both his belly and the Glock 41 Gen 4 pistol riding in a belt holster on his waistband. Fully loaded with its standard 13-round mag, it weighed 36 ounces. His size 14 shoes hit the pavement with noisy splats. His hair was, to put it kindly, disheveled. Decker worked at the FBI on a joint task force. He was on his way to a meeting at the Hoover Building. He was not looking forward to it. He sensed that a change was coming, and Decker did not like change. He'd experienced enough of it in the last 2 years to last him a lifetime. He had just settled into a new routine with the FBI, and he wanted to keep it that way. Yet apparently, that was out of his control. He stepped around a barricade that had been set up on the sidewalk and that stretched partway into the street. A manhole cover surrounded by an orange web barrier had been opened, and workers were congregated around the area. One man in a hard hat emerged at the opening of the manhole and was passed a tool by another man. Most of the other workers stood around, some drinking coffee and others chatting. "Nice work if you can get it," thought Decker. He saw Dabney up ahead but didn't focus on him. Decker didn't see Berkshire because he wasn't looking that far up the street. He passed by the garage entrance and nodded at the uniformed FBI security officer in a small windowed guard shack situated on the sidewalk. The ramrod straight man nodded back, his eyes covered by sunglasses as his gaze dutifully swept the street. His right hand was perched on top of his holstered service weapon. It was a 9mm chambered with Speer Gold .G2 rounds that the FBI used because of their penetration capability. One shot, one down could have been the ammo's motto. Then again, most ammo would do that, so long as it hit the intended target in the right place. A bird zipped across in front of Decker, perched on a lamppost, and looked down curiously at the passersby. The air was chilly, and Decker shivered a bit, even in his thick pullover. The sun was hidden behind cloud cover that had materialized on the horizon about an hour before, passed over the Potomac, and settled upon Washington like a gray dome. Up ahead, Dabney was nearing the end of the block, where he would turn left. The FBI's business appointments entrance was located down there. Years ago, public tours were freely given, and people could view the famed FBI lab and watch special agents practicing their aim on the shooting range. In the modern era of terrorism, that was no more. After 9/11, the tours were canceled, but then restarted in 2008. The FBI had even put in an education center for visitors. But a request for a visit had to be filed at least a month ahead of time to allow the FBI to do a thorough background check. Most federal buildings were now simply fortresses, hard to get into and maybe harder to get out of. Dabney slowed as he approached the corner. Berkshire, by contrast, quickened her pace. Decker continued to lope along, his long strides eating up ground until he was only about 10 yards behind Dabney. Berkshire was about 5 yards on the other side of Dabney. Moments later, that distance was halved. A few clicks after that, they were barely 3 feet apart. Decker now saw Berkshire because she had drawn so close to Dabney. He was about 10 feet behind the pair when he started to make the turn, too. Berkshire glanced over at Dabney, seemingly noticing him for the first time. Dabney didn't look back at her, at least not initially. A few seconds later, he saw her gazing at him. He smiled, and if he'd been wearing a hat, he might have even doffed it to her in a show of courtesy. Berkshire didn't smile back. Her hand went to her purse clasp. Dabney slowed a bit more. Across the street, Decker spotted a vendor selling breakfast burritos from a food truck and wondered if he had time to buy one before his meeting. When he decided he didn't and his waistline would be worse off for it, he looked back. Berkshire and Dabney were now beside each other. Decker didn't think anything of it. He just assumed they knew each other and were perhaps rendezvousing here. He looked at his watch to check the time. He didn't want to be late. If his life was going to change, he wanted to be on time for it. When he looked back up, he froze. Dabney had fallen 2 steps behind the woman. Unknown to Berkshire, he was aiming a compact Beretta at the back of her head. Decker reached for his weapon and was about to call out when Dabney pulled the trigger. Berkshire jerked forward as the round slammed into the back of her head at an upward angle. It blew out her medulla, pierced her brain pan, banged like a pinball off her skull, and exited through her nose, leaving a wound 3 times the size of the entry due to the bullet's built-up wall of kinetic energy. She fell forward onto the pavement, her face mostly obliterated, the concrete tatted with her blood. His pistol out, Decker ran forward as others on the street screamed and ran away. Dabney was still wielding his weapon. His heart pounding, Decker aimed his Glock at Dabney and shouted, "FBI, put your gun down, now!" Dabney turned to him. He did not put down his gun. Decker could hear the running footsteps behind him. The guard from the shack was sprinting toward them, his gun also out. Decker glanced quickly over his shoulder, saw this, and held up his creds with his free hand. "I'm with the FBI. He just shot the woman." He let his lanyard go and assumed a 2-handed shooting stance, his muzzle aimed at Dabney's chest. The FBI uniform ran up to stand next to him, his gun pointed at Dabney. "Put the gun down now," the guard shouted. "Last chance, or we will shoot." It was two guns versus one. The response should have been obvious. "Lie down, and you won't fall down." Dabney looked first at the guard, and then at Decker, and smiled.
"Don't!" shouted Decker.
Walter Dabney pressed the gun's muzzle to the bottom of his chin and pulled the trigger for a second and final time. Chapter 2. Darkness. It awaited us all, individually, in our final moments. Amos Decker was thinking that as he sat in the chair and studied the body. Ann Berkshire lay on a metal table in the FBI's morgue. All her clothes had been removed and placed in evidence bags to be later analyzed. Her naked body was under a sheet. Her destroyed face was covered as well, although the fabric was stained with her blood and destroyed tissue. A post-mortem was legally required, even though there was no doubt whatsoever as to what had caused the woman's death. Walter Dabney, by an extraordinary twist, was not dead. Not yet, anyway. The doctors at the hospital to which he'd been rushed held no hope that he would recover or even regain consciousness. The bullet had tunneled right through his brain. It was a miracle he had not died instantly. Alex Jameson, Ross Bogart, two of Decker's colleagues on a joint task force composed of civilians and FBI agents, were with Dabney at the hospital right now. If he regained consciousness, they would want to capture anything he might utter that would explain why he had murdered Ann Berkshire on a public street and then attempted to take his own life. Dabney's recovering to the point of being questioned was simply not going to happen, the doctors had told them. So for now, Decker simply sat in the darkness and stared at the covered body. Although the room was not actually dark for him. For Decker, it was an ethereally bright blue. A near-fatal hit he'd received on the football field had commingled his sensory pathways, a condition known as synesthesia. For him, death was represented by the color blue. He had seen it on the street when Dabney had killed Berkshire, and he was seeing it now. Decker had given statements to the D.C. police and the FBI, as had the security guard who had joined him at the scene. There hadn't been much to say. Dabney had pulled a gun and shot Berkshire and then himself. That was crystal clear. What wasn't clear was why he had done it. The overhead lights came on, and a woman in a white lab coat walked in. The medical examiner introduced herself as Lynn Wainwright. She was in her 40s, with the compressed, slightly haunted features of a person who had seen every sort of violence one human could wreak on another. Decker rose, showed her his ID, and said he was with an FBI task force, and also that he had witnessed the murder. Decker glanced over as Todd Milligan, the fourth member of the joint task force, entered the room. A fifth member, Lisa Davenport, a psychologist by training, had not returned to the group, opting instead to go back to private practice in Chicago. Milligan was in his mid-30s, 6 feet tall, with close-cropped hair and a physique that appeared chiseled out of granite. He and Decker had initially butted heads, but now the two men got along as well as Decker could with anyone. Decker had trouble relating to people. That had not always been the case, because he was not the same person he had once been. In addition to the synesthesia, Decker also had hyperthymesia, or perfect recall, after suffering a brain trauma on the same vicious hit in his very short career in the NFL. It had altered his personality, changing him from gregarious and fun-loving to aloof and lacking the ability to recognize social cues, a skill most people took for granted. People first meeting him would assume he was somewhere on the autism spectrum, and they might not be far off in that assumption.
"How you doing, Decker?" said Milligan.
He was dressed like always in a dark suit with a spotless crisp white shirt and striped tie. Next to him, the shabbily attired Decker looked borderline homeless.
"Better than she is," said Decker, indicating Berkshire's body. "What do we know about her so far?"
Milligan took out a small electronic notebook from his inside coat pocket and scrolled down the screen.
While he was doing that, Decker watched as Wainwright removed the sheet from Berkshire's body and prepared the instruments necessary to perform the autopsy. Ann Meredith Berkshire, 59, unmarried, substitute school teacher at a Catholic school in Fairfax County. She lives, or rather lived, in Reston. No relatives have come forward, but we're still checking. Why was she down at the Hoover Building? We don't know. We don't know if she was even going there, and she wasn't scheduled to teach at the school today. Walter Dabney? 61, married, with 4 grown daughters, has a successful government contracting business, does work with the Bureau and other agencies. Before that, he worked at NSA for 10 years, lives in McLean in a big house. He's done very well for himself. Did very well for himself, corrected Decker. His wife and kids? We spoke with his wife. She's hysterical. The kids are spread all over the place. One lives in France. They're all coming here. Any of them have any idea why he would do this? We haven't spoken to them all, but nothing pops so far. They're apparently still in shock. Decker next asked the most obvious question. Any connection between Berkshire and Dabney? We're just starting out, but nothing as yet. You think he was just looking to shoot someone before he killed himself and she was the closest? She was definitely the closest, said Decker. But if you're going to kill yourself, why take an innocent person along? What would be the point? Maybe the guy went nuts. We might find something in his background to explain his going off the deep end. He had a briefcase and an ID. It seems he was heading to the Hoover Building. Was he going to a meeting? Yes. We confirmed that he was meeting to go over a project his firm was handling for the Bureau. All routine. So he goes off the deep end, but he could still put on a suit and come downtown for a routine meeting? Milligan nodded. I see the inconsistency, but it's still possible. Anything's possible, until it's not, Decker replied. Decker walked over to stand next to Wainwright.
Murder weapon was a Beretta 9mm. Contact wound at the base of the neck with an upward trajectory. She died on impact.
Wainwright was readying a striker saw that she would use to cut open Berkshire's skull. She said,
Definitely jibes with the external injuries.
If Dabney dies, will you be doing the post?
She nodded.
The Bureau is taking the lead on this, since Dabney was a contractor for them and it happened on their doorstep, so I'm your girl.
Decker turned away from her and said to Milligan, Has the FBI assigned a team to the case yet? Milligan nodded. Who's the team? Do you know them?
I know them very well, because they're us.
Decker blinked. Come again?
Bogart's team, meaning us, has been assigned to the case.
But we do cold cases.
Well, that's what the meeting today was about. They were changing our assignment, cold to hot cases. And since you were on the scene of this one, it made sense to let us work it. So we're a go.
Even though I'm a witness to the crime?
It's not as though there's going to be any doubt as to what happened, Decker. And there were lots of witnesses to what he did. They don't need you.
But I came here to do cold cases, protested Decker.
Well, we don't get to decide that, Decker. The higher-ups do.
And they can just pull the rug out from under us like that, without even asking?
Milligan attempted a smile, but when he saw the troubled expression on Decker's face, the look faded.
It's a bureaucracy, Decker, and we have to follow orders. At least Ross and I do. I guess you and Jameson could call it quits, but my career is locked up with the Bureau.
He paused.
We'll still be catching bad guys, just for newer crimes. You'll still get to do what you do so well.
Decker nodded, but hardly looked appeased by Milligan's words. He looked down at Berkshire's body. The pulse of blue assailed him from all corners. He felt slightly sick to his stomach. Wainwright glanced over and registered on the name on Decker's ID.
Wait a minute. Amos? Decker? Are you the guy who can't forget anything?
When Decker didn't say anything, Milligan said quickly, Yes, he is. Wainwright said,
Heard you guys have solved quite a few old cases over the last several months, principally the Melvin Mars matter.
It was a team effort, said Milligan, but we couldn't have done it without Decker.
Decker stirred and pointed to a purple smudge on the back of Berkshire's hand.
What's that?
Let's have a closer look,
Wainwright said. She gripped a magnifying glass set on a rotating arm and positioned it over the mark. She turned on a light and aimed it at the dead woman's hand. Peering through the glass, she said,
Appears to be a stamp of some sort.
Decker took a look through the glass. Dominion Hospice. He looked at Milligan, who was already tapping keys on his notebook. Milligan read down the screen. Okay, got it. It's over near Reston Hospital. They handle terminal cases, obviously. Decker looked down at Berkshire. If the mark is still on her hand, presumably she went there today. A shower would have taken it off. Do you think she went to visit someone? Asked Milligan. Well, she wasn't exactly terminal, until Dabney killed her. He abruptly walked out without another word. Wainwright looked at Milligan with raised eyebrows at this sudden departure. He kind of just does that. A lot, said Milligan. I've sort of gotten used to it.
Then you're a better person than I am,
replied Wainwright. She held up the striker saw.
Because if he kept walking out on me like that, I might just clock him with this.
Chapter 3. Walter Dabney's chest rose and fell with the spasmodic twitch of someone not long for this world. It was as though the lungs were the weary rear guard holding out as the spirit prepared to exit the body. Alex Jameson was in her late 20s, tall, slim, and pretty, with long brunette hair. She sat on the right side of the hospital bed in the CCU. Ross Bogart, an FBI special agent in his late 40s, with a bit of gray the only thing marring his perfectly combed dark hair, stood ramrod straight on the left. His fingers clutched the bed's safety rail. Dabney lay in the bed, hooked up to a complex array of monitoring lines and tubes carrying medications. His right eye was an empty crater because the bullet he'd fired into his chin had burst from there after catapulting through parts of the brain. His facial skin was deathly gray, where it wasn't swollen and stained purple by burst capillaries. His breathing was erratic, and the monitor showed his vitals to be fluctuating all over the place. He was in the critical care unit, the place designated for the sickest and most badly injured patients at the hospital. But he wasn't just injured. Walter Dabney was dying. The doctors who had been in and out during the day had all confirmed that it was simply a matter of time before the brain told the heart to stop pumping. And there was nothing they could do about it. The damage was such that no medicine and no surgery could bring the man back. They were just counting down the time until death. Mrs. Eleanor Dabney, better known as Ellie, had arrived 30 minutes after the FBI had told her what had happened. They would have to question her, but right now the woman was simply a grieving widow-to-be. She was currently in the bathroom throwing up, a nurse assisting her. Bogart eyed Jameson. She seemed to sense his attention and glanced up. Any word from Decker? He asked quietly. She checked her phone and shook her head.
He was going to be at the morgue with Berkshire's body.
She thumbed in a text to him and sent it off.
I copied Todd on it,
she said. Bogart nodded. Good. He'll keep Decker on track. They both knew that Decker was not always the best at communicating. In fact, he pretty much sucked at it. Bogart looked down at Dabney again. Nothing in the guy's record to indicate something like this happening, and no connection that we can find to Berkshire. Jameson said,
There must be something, unless it was completely random, and that doesn't make much sense either.
Bogart nodded in agreement and then glanced at the monitor. The dying man's heart rate and respiration danced around like bare feet on sizzling coals. Chances are very good he's going to die without saying anything.
But if he does say something, we'll be here,
replied Jameson. The bathroom door opened, and out came the nurse and Ellie Dabney. She was tall and broad-shouldered, with long legs and a slender waist and narrow hips. Her features were quite attractive, the jaw elegantly structured, the cheekbones high and firm, the eyes large and a pleasing light blue. Her hair was long, and she had let it go naturally silver. She looked like she might have been quite the athlete in her youth. Now, in her early 60s, the mother of 4 grown children with 3 grandchildren and 1 mortally wounded husband, The stricken woman appeared about as close to death as one could get without actually being dead. Bogart placed a chair next to the bed for her as Jameson rose and helped the nurse guide Ellie over to the chair, into which she fell rather than sat. The nurse checked the monitor, gave Bogart an ominous look, and left, closing the door behind her. Ellie had reached through the rails and gripped her husband's hand, her forehead resting against the top of the bed rail. Bogart stepped back, and Jameson resumed her seat. They exchanged glances while listening to the woman's quiet sobs.
"Mrs. Dabney, we can arrange to have your children brought here when they get into town," he said after a few moments.
She didn't respond to this at first, but finally nodded.
"Do you have that information, or is there someone else we can—"
She lifted her head, and without looking at him, said,
"My daughter, Jules, she'll know that."
She pulled a phone from her pocket, tapped some keys, and passed it to him. Bogart wrote the phone number down, handed Ellie her phone back, and walked out of the room. Jameson put a hand on the older woman's shoulder and said,
"I'm so very sorry, Mrs. Dabney."
Did Walt really hurt someone? The FBI, they said—"
"We don't have to talk about that now."
Ellie turned her tear-stained face to Jameson.
"He couldn't have. Are you sure someone didn't shoot him? You see, Walt wouldn't hurt anything. He...
Her voice trailed off, and she placed her forehead back on the rail. The monitor started to beep, and they both glanced at it, but the device quieted down.
"We are sure, Mrs. Dabney. I wish I could tell you otherwise. There were a lot of witnesses."
Ellie blew her nose on a tissue and said in a firmer voice,
"He's not going to recover, is he?"
"The doctors aren't hopeful, no."
I didn't even know he owned a gun."
After studying the woman for a few seconds, Jameson asked,
"Did you notice a change in your husband recently?"
"In what way?"
Ellie said absently.
"Mood, concerns at work, appetite changed. Maybe he drank more than normal. Any signs of depression?"
Ellie sat back in her chair, wadded the tissue up in her hand, and stared down at her lap. Outside the door, footsteps could be heard, along with occasional running feet, the sounds of a monitor alarm, voices over a PA, and equipment and patients being rolled up and down the corridor. The air smelled like hospitals always did, antiseptic, and the air was perpetually chilly. There was also an ominous tenseness present in the CCU, as though only a monitor's sudden warning screech separated the living from the dead.
"Walt didn't talk about business at home. He didn't really drink at home either, although I know that he did at business dinners and industry events, that sort of thing. I attended some with him, but he only drank enough to socialize, to get deals done, build contacts, you know, that sort of thing."
"I understand. Were there any financial worries?"
"Not that I knew of. But Walter handled all that. We never had any bill collectors show up at the house, if that's what you mean."
"Did his mood change?"
She dabbed at her eyes and shot a glance at her husband before quickly looking away, as though she was uncomfortable conveying information about him to a stranger.
"He had a variety of moods. He worked very hard, and when business was good, he was happy. When it was down, he got depressed, just like anybody would."
"So nothing out of the ordinary."
Ellie balled up the tissue even more and then tossed it into the trash can with finality. She turned to Jameson, who waited patiently. If being around Amos Decker had taught her anything, it was patience, for both positive and negative reasons.
"He went on a trip recently."
"Where?"
"That was the unusual thing. He didn't tell me where. He had never done that before."
"How long was he gone?"
Jameson asked.
"I think about 4 days. It could have been longer. He was on another trip in New York and left from there. He called me and said something unexpected had come up and that he had to attend to it and wasn't sure how long he'd be gone."
"Plane, train, another country?"
"I don't know. He did tell me it had to do with a potential client. He had to smooth over something. The way he described it, the matter didn't seem too significant. I suppose his office would have handled the travel arrangements."
Okay. And he mentioned nothing to you about it when he got home?
Nothing. I just assumed it was business. But from that day on, there was something, I don't know, off.
And when was this?
About a month ago.
And your husband has his own government contracting firm?
Ellie nodded.
Walter Dabney and Associates. It's located in Reston. Everything they work on is pretty much classified. It started out with just my husband, but now about 70 people work there. He has partners at the firm, but Walter is president and owns a controlling interest.
Her eyes widened.
Oh, my God. I guess I'll own it now.
She looked in alarm at Jameson.
Does that mean I'll have to run it? I don't know anything about his business. I don't even have a security clearance.
Jameson gripped her hand.
I don't think you need to worry about those details right now, Mrs. Dabney.
Ellie relaxed and looked back at her husband.
What was the person's name again? That Walter... They told me, but I can't remember. Everything is just a blur right now.
Anne Berkshire. She was a substitute teacher at a Catholic high school in Fairfax. Do you know her?
Ellie shook her head.
I never heard of her. And I don't know why Walt would know her either, high school teacher. Walt and I had our children fairly early. Jules, our oldest, is 37, and our oldest grandkid is only in first grade. And they don't even live in Virginia anyway. And we're not Catholic, we're Presbyterian.
Right, well, thank you for the information. You've been very helpful.
Will I need to get a lawyer?
Ellie blurted out. Jameson looked uncomfortable.
I'm really not the one to advise you about that. If you or your husband used a lawyer or no one, you should check with that person.
Ellie nodded dumbly and then reached through the rails and gripped her husband's hand once more.
A minute later, Bogart came back in. It's all taken care of, Mrs. Dabney, he said. According to your daughter, everyone except Natalie will be in by tonight.
Natalie lives in Paris. I tried to phone her, but no one answered, and it wasn't something I could leave on a voicemail or tell her by email.
Your daughter Jules reached her and told her the situation. She's trying to get a flight here as soon as possible.
I really can't believe this is happening,
said Ellie.
When Walt left this morning, everything was perfect. And now...
She looked up at them.
It's all gone. Just like that.
Just like that,
thought Jameson. Chapter 4. They had traveled from a place filled with dead bodies to a place filled with dying people. After making inquiries at the front desk, Decker and Milligan had been given over to the director of Dominion Hospice, Sally Palmer. The woman was shocked to hear of Anne Berkshire's death.
She was just here this morning,
she said as she faced them from across the desk in her small, cramped office.
That's what we understand, said Decker, and it's why we're here. We saw that her hand was stamped with the name of the hospice.
Yes, we do that as part of our security procedure.
Does this place need much security? Asked Milligan.
Palmer looked at him sternly.
Our patients are weak and on heavy medications. They can hardly protect themselves. It falls to us to do that, and we take that matter very seriously. All visitors are checked in through the front entrance. The hand stamp is easily seen, and we change the color every day. That way, at a glance, our staff knows if a visitor has been properly cleared through or not.
Decker asked, Did Berkshire have a family member who's a patient here? Is that why she was here this morning?
Oh, no, Anne was a volunteer. She would come and spend time with certain patients. Oftentimes, the patient's family may not live in the immediate area and visits aren't so frequent. We have volunteers, carefully vetted, of course, who come in and talk to the patients, read to them, or just sit with them. It's not easy dying, and it's even harder dying alone.
Did Berkshire talk to anyone in particular today? Asked Milligan.
I can certainly find out. Excuse me for a minute.
Palmer rose and left. Milligan took out his phone and checked messages. Dabney's wife is at the hospital with her husband. Alex says he hasn't regained consciousness and probably won't.
Did the wife tell them anything?
She didn't know Anne Berkshire and was pretty sure her husband didn't either. She also knew nothing about her husband's business and had no idea why he would do what he did. But Alex texted again. Mrs. Dabney said her husband had taken an unexplained trip about a month ago, and that he didn't seem the same afterwards.
Not the same how?
Different mood, apparently. And he wouldn't tell her where he went.
Okay.
Milligan looked around the small office. Do you really think we're going to get a lead from this place?
People are killed by strangers, but most people know the one who kills them.
Well, that's always comforting, said Milligan dourly. The men lapsed into silence until Palmer returned a few minutes later.
She met with three patients early this morning, Dorothy Vitters, Joey Scott, and Albert Drews.
Were they people she normally would visit? Asked Decker.
Yes.
You said she came in early this morning. Did she usually come in at that time?
Well, no, come to think of it. She usually came in around noon. Our patients are generally more alert then.
Can we speak with them? Asked Decker.
Palmer looked taken aback.
I'm not sure what they can tell you. They're very ill and weak.
Decker rose. I appreciate that, but Anne Berkshire was murdered this morning, and it's our job to find out why. And if she came here at an unusual time, shortly before she went downtown and was killed, then we have to run that possible lead down. I hope you can understand that.
Milligan added quickly, we'll be as gentle as possible.
Do you have to tell them that Anne was killed? That will be extremely upsetting for them.
Milligan said, we'll do our best to avoid that.
Decker said nothing. His eyes were already on the hallway. Dorothy Vitters was in her late 80s, frail and shrunken in the last bed she would occupy. Because of patient confidentiality, Palmer had not told them what specific illness she might have. She left them in the doorway and walked back to her office. Decker stood in the doorway and looked around at the small, sparsely furnished space.
You okay? Said Milligan in a low voice.
Decker was not okay, not really. What he was seeing here wasn't the flash of electric blue he associated with death, but rather navy blue. That was a first for him, but when he looked at the terminally ill Vitters, he could understand why. Near death was apparently represented in his mind simply by another shade of blue.
Well, that is interesting. My altered mind keeps throwing me curves.
He didn't want to be here when Vitters died, because he didn't want the Navy to abruptly change to electric blue.
I'm good, he finally said.
He walked into the room, pulled up a chair, and sat next to the bed. Milligan stood next to him.
Mrs. Vitters? I'm Amos Decker, and this is Todd Milligan. We're here to talk to you about Anne Berkshire. She was in to see you this morning, we understand.
Vitters looked up at him from deeply sunken eyes. Her skin was a pale gray, her eyes watery and her breathing shallow. Decker could see the port near her clavicle where her pain meds were administered.
Anne was here,
she said slowly.
I was surprised because it was earlier than usual.
Do you remember what you talked about?
Who are you?
Decker was about to take out his creds when Milligan stopped him. Milligan said, we're friends of Anne's. She asked us to stop in today because she wanted to come back and keep talking to you, but then found out she couldn't make it.
The watery eyes turned to alarm.
Is she all right? She's not sick, is she?
She's feeling no pain at all, said Decker quite truthfully.
He was counting on the fact that whatever meds the woman was on would slow her mental processes somewhat. Otherwise, Vitters might figure out that nothing they were saying made much sense.
Oh, well, it was just the usual things. Weather. A book she was reading and telling me about. My cat.
Your cat? Said Milligan.
Sonny's dead now. Oh, it's been 10 years, if it's been a day. But Anne liked cats.
So nothing other than that? Asked Decker.
No, not that I recall. She wasn't here that long.
Did she seem okay to you? Nothing out of sorts?
Her voice grew more strident.
Are you sure she's all right? Why are you here asking these questions? I might be dying, but I'm not stupid.
Decker saw the watery eyes turn to Flint before flickering out again.
Well, if you have to know the truth, the fact is, Milligan cut in.
We know you're not stupid, Mrs. Vitters. As my colleague was about to say, the fact is, Anne fell down and hit her head today. She'll be fine, but she's got short-term amnesia, and she needs to remember the passcode to her phone and her apartment's alarm system and her computer. She sent us here to find out what she was talking about to people so that we can tell her and maybe jog her memory. The doctor said that that might do it.
Vitters looked relieved.
Oh, well, I'm so sorry she fell.
Decker glanced at Milligan for an instant before gazing back at Vitters and saying,
So anything you can tell us would be appreciated.
Well, again, we didn't talk about much. Although it did seem that Anne was preoccupied. She usually led the conversations we had, but today I had to prompt her a few times.
Milligan glanced sharply at Decker, but Decker kept his gaze on Vitters. Did you ask her if anything was wrong?
I did, actually. But she said everything was fine. She just had something on her mind, but she didn't say what.
Do you know if you were the first person that Anne visited today, or were there others before you?
I think I was the last. She mentioned she had to leave after seeing me. She had somewhere to go.
She didn't mention where that was?
No.
Decker rose and turned to leave. Milligan said hastily, Thank you for your help. Is there anything we can do for you? Vitters smiled grimly.
Put in a good word for me with the man upstairs.
As they left, Milligan whispered, Hey, Decker, you need to go a little easy with these folks, okay? They're dying. He passed by Decker, who turned and looked back at Vitters lying in the bed, her eyes now closed. He walked back over to her and looked down. The navy blue image in his mind was starting to turn electric blue. Decker didn't believe he could foresee someone's death, but his mind was obviously making the logical leap with the terminally ill Vitters. He reached down and adjusted the woman's pillow to make her head rest more comfortably. His hand grazed over the white hair, and then he said in a low voice, I'm sorry, Mrs. Vitters. He didn't see Milligan watching him from the doorway. The FBI agent hurried off before Decker turned around. Chapter 5. Joey Scott was an even sadder case than Dorothy Vitters. Decker and Milligan stood in the doorway with Palmer. Scott was only 10 years old, but his short life was nearing its end. Eschewing patient privacy law, Palmer, who had escorted them here, had said in response to their blank looks,
Leukemia, the untreatable kind.
Milligan said, But why would Berkshire have to visit him? Don't his parents come? Palmer bristled.
He was in the process of being adopted out of foster care. When he got sick, his adoptive parents pulled out. I guess they wanted a healthy model,
she added in disgust.
And it's not like they couldn't afford it. Anne visited him at least twice a week. She was really all Joey had.
Then she turned and left, her face full of despair. Decker looked down at the little body in the bed, and his thoughts wandered back to the daughter he'd once had. Molly had been murdered before her 10th birthday. Decker had found her and his wife's bodies at their old home. And because of his hyperthymesia, he would always remember every detail of this tragedy like it had just occurred that second. There could be nothing that ever happened to Decker that could be more horrible and depressing than finding his family murdered. But seeing this came close. He sat down next to the boy, who slowly opened his eyes. IV and monitoring lines ran all over his withered frame. With a quick glance at Milligan, Decker said, Hello, Joey. I'm Amos. This is my friend Todd. Joey raised a hand and made a little wave. I understand your friend Anne was in today. Joey nodded. Did you have a good talk?
She read to me,
Joey said in a small voice. A book? He nodded.
Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. It's on the shelf over there. She said she'd be back tomorrow to finish it.
Decker reached over and snagged the book, flipping through some pages until he came to the bookmark about 10 pages from the end. He glanced at Milligan before looking back at Joey. "That's great. Is that all she did? Read?" Joey shook his head.
"We talked some."
"What about?"
"Are you friends with Anne?"
Decker said, "I just saw her this morning. She's the reason we came to see you. She wanted us to meet her friends here."
"Oh, okay."
Milligan said, "How long have you been here, Joey?" Joey blinked up at him.
"I don't know."
Milligan took a step back and put a hand against the wall. He looked hopelessly at Decker. Decker said, "Do you remember what you talked about with Anne? Maybe things about the book?"
"She asked me if I saw the sun come up."
Decker looked to the large window, which faced east. He slowly looked back at Joey. "Did you?" Joey nodded.
"It was nice."
"I used to get up early and watch the sunrise when I was a kid," said Decker, drawing a surprised look from Milligan. "I grew up in Ohio, so the sun got to us later than it does here." On the nightstand next to the bed was a framed photo. Decker picked it up. It was a picture of Peyton Manning. "You like Manning?" Joey nodded.
"I used to watch football a lot, and I played before I got sick."
"I played too." Joey ran his gaze over Decker's huge physique.
"You look like a football player. I might have grown up to be big like you."
Milligan rubbed at his eyes. Regaining his composure, he said, "Joey, Decker here played in the NFL for the Cleveland Browns." The little boy's eyes grew wide and a tiny smile crept across his features.
"You did?"
Decker nodded. "My career was short and not necessarily sweet." He put the photo back. "Before that, I was an Ohio State Buckeye. Some of the best years of my life."
"Wow,"
said Joey.
"Do you know Peyton Manning?"
"No, but he was one of the greatest. First ballot Hall of Famer." He sat back. "Did you talk with Anne about anything else?" The smile faded.
"Not really."
"Did she tell you where she was going after she left here?" Joey shook his head. Decker rose, glanced at Milligan, and said, "Thanks, Joey. You've been a big help."
"You're welcome."
Milligan looked down at him and said, "Hey, would it be okay if I came back and saw you again?"
"Sure. Maybe you can come with Anne."
Milligan said, "Well, we'll see." He took a card from his pocket and put it on the nightstand next to the Peyton Manning photo. "You need anything, have them give me a call on that number, okay?"
"Okay."
"Thanks again."
"Can I shake your hand?"
asked Joey, eyeing Decker.
"I never met an NFL player before."
Decker put out his hand and slowly gripped the little boy's. It was like a whale swallowing a minnow. "It was an honor meeting you, Joey." Decker put the book back on the shelf and walked out, followed by Milligan. "Damn," said Milligan. "I'm not sure I'll ever smile again." "You will," said Decker. "But whenever you feel things are bad, you'll think of Joey, and then things will look a lot better for you." Albert Drews was in his 40s and volunteered that he had final stage pancreatic cancer. He was pale and thin, and his skin looked brittle and jaundiced.
"By the time I had any symptoms, it was too damn late," he said, after they'd introduced themselves and shown him their IDs. "Chemo, radiation, kicked the shit out of me. Then I go into remission for about 2 months, and it comes back like a hurricane, and now this is it."
He stopped talking and started breathing heavily, as though this bit of speaking had exhausted him. When his lungs settled down, he said,
"You're lucky you caught me now. When my pain meds kick in, I'm out for the count. Morphine. Don't know what I'd do without it. The pain. Well, it's not nice," he added resignedly.
"I'm sorry to be bothering you, Mr. Drews," said Decker. Drews waved this off.
"It's not like I've got anything else to do except lie here and wait to die."
"We understand that Anne Berkshire came to talk to you today."
"This morning. Why?"
Decker decided to just tell the truth. "She was shot and killed this morning in D.C., shortly after she left here."
"What?"
gasped Drews, rising up on his elbows. He started to cough. Milligan poured out a glass of water from a carafe on the nightstand and helped Drews drink it. He shot Decker a stern look and then stepped back with the empty glass. Drews finally settled down and stared helplessly up at them. He gasped.
"Anne shot? How? Why?"
"We don't know why. That's why we're here."
"But I don't know anything."
"You may know more than you think," said Decker. "What did you two talk about today?" His brows knitted, Drews said,
"She was a nice lady. Started visiting me about 4 weeks ago. We just talked about things. Nothing in particular. Nothing of importance. Just things to pass the time. Take my mind off my situation."
"Did she talk about herself?"
"Sometimes. She said she was a school teacher. She wasn't married. No children."
"What did you do before you became sick?" asked Milligan.
"I was a software engineer with a local tech company."
His eyes closed and he started breathing deeply. "Are you okay?" asked Milligan. Drews opened his eyes and snapped,
"No, I'm not okay. I'm terminal, all right? I'm dying."
"I'm sorry, Mr. Drews. That's not what I meant. I'm sorry," Milligan added in a contrite voice. Decker studied Drews. "Did you ever talk with Mrs. Berkshire about the work you did?"
"No. What would have been the point?"
"Just chit-chat."
"No, and that seems like a lifetime ago. I barely remember it."
"You're not married."
"How do you know that?"
"No ring on your finger, and no mark that showed a ring used to be there." After a moment, he said resignedly,
"I never met the right woman, I guess."
"Parents still alive?" Drews shook his head.
"I've got a brother, but he lives in Australia. He came up when I got sick and stayed a while, but he had to get back. He has 5 kids.
Drews paused.
"He'll come back for the funeral. He's my executor. I'm being cremated. Makes it easier all around."
Drews closed his eyes and his lips trembled, but then he reopened them and sighed.
"You never think you can talk so candidly about your coming death, but when you don't have a choice, you just do."
"What do the doctors say?" asked Decker. Drews shrugged.
"Some days it feels like tomorrow will be it. Some days I hope tomorrow will be it."
"We're sorry to have bothered you, Mr. Drews. We appreciate your help." As Decker rose, Drews put out a hand and lightly gripped Decker's fingers. The man's skin felt like ice.
"Anne was really nice. She didn't have to come here and do what she did, but she wanted to. I hope you find whoever did this."
"We already found him, Mr. Drews," said Decker. "Now we just have to find out why he did it." Chapter 6. "A substitute school teacher?" said Decker. He was looking around at Anne Berkshire's condo on the top floor of a luxury building directly across the street from the Reston Town Center. Milligan nodded. "That's what her file says." "You know this area better than me. What do you think a place like this would run?" Milligan looked around at the space. It had tall windows, high ceilings, hardwood floors, about 3,000 square feet of professionally decorated space with sweeping views of the area, and a large private balcony with a hot tub.
$2 million, maybe more.
"And the building management says she has a Mercedes SL600 parked in the underground garage."
"That's well over $100,000, said Milligan.
"Did she inherit?"
"I don't know. We'll have to dig on that."
"How long has she been a teacher?"
"She's been substitute teaching for 4 years.
"Before that?"
"She lived in Atlanta for 3 years.
"Doing what?"
"We don't have an occupation, just an address."
"Before that?"
"Seattle."
"So no job there either?"
"Not that we could find."
"Before that?"
"We didn't find anything else on her."
"How far does her file go back?"
"When you add it all up, about 10 years.
"But she was nearly 60, so that takes us back to her late 40s. What about before then?"
"We couldn't find anything. but we haven't had much time to dig yet. Something else will turn up, and it'll probably explain the money angle. She might have been injured in an accident and gotten a big settlement, or maybe a malpractice suit. Hell, maybe she won the lottery. Decker didn't look convinced. She's very neat, remarked Milligan. I think the term would be minimalist, said Decker, noting the spare furnishings. He walked into the master bedroom and looked through the walk-in closet. Four pairs of shoes, a few purses, and bags. No jewelry that I can see, and no safe where they might be kept. He looked at Milligan. We weren't rich by any stretch, but my wife had probably 30 pairs of shoes, and about that many purses and bags. And she had some jewelry. Milligan nodded. Mine does, too. You think Berkshire was just unique, or is it something else? I also haven't seen a single photo of anyone. Not Berkshire, or family or friends. Nothing. In fact, the entire place looks like a model unit. I bet she bought it furnished, and none of this is even hers. What does that tell us? That maybe she was not who she appeared to be. You think Dabney knew her? Maybe. And did we confirm that she was going to the FBI? I just assumed that because of where she was. But we need more than assumptions now. We've confirmed that she wasn't scheduled to meet with anyone at Hoover, and visitors just coming to tour the place need to file a request ahead of time, so the Bureau can do a background check. And there's no record of such a request for her. Decker sat on the bed and looked around the room. She leaves here, goes to the hospice, and then heads downtown. She had a Metro card in her purse that showed she got off at the Federal Triangle stop about 10 minutes before she was killed. And she was seen in one of the surveillance cameras leaving that station. And then Dabney shoots her. Milligan stared at Decker. If he planned to shoot her, how did he know what time she was going to be there? Or that she was going to be there at all? Maybe he was the reason she was there, suggested Decker. What? He communicated with her and told her to meet him outside the FBI building? Maybe. We're checking phone, email, texts, fax, all the typical communication portals to see if we can find a connection. They may have done it face to face. If so, we may not find a record. If he didn't plan for her to come there, then only two other explanations make sense. He either knew she was going to be there from some other means, or it was a coincidence, finished Milligan. And he could have easily killed someone other than Berkshire. And if so, for what reason? Why kill a stranger in such a random fashion, other than the guy being nuts? Milligan shook his head. I don't have a clue. Decker rose off the bed and held up a set of car keys. They're to the Mercedes. They were in a drawer in her closet. Let's go check it out. Berkshire's Mercedes was a silver convertible and sat in a coveted slot near the elevators. Decker used the wireless key fob to open the vehicle, and Milligan began to search it. The confines of the car were too small for the bulky Decker to easily navigate. Milligan handed Decker a packet of materials from the glove box and continued his search. 5 minutes later, Milligan got out and shook his head. Nothing. Smells like it was just taken off the lot. Decker held up the envelope Milligan had handed him. Registration says it's only 3 years old. Check the mileage. Milligan did so. About 5,000 miles. So she's barely driven it, really. I wonder how she got to work. Public transportation? There's no metro stop within walking distance from here, and there's none where she worked as a teacher. And why would you go by bus if you could drive this baby? We'll just have to file that one away as another curious question with no current answer. Milligan shut the car door, and Decker used the key fob to lock it. Milligan checked his watch. It's getting late, so where to now?
To see another dying man, said Decker.
Chapter 7. The breaths were coming so slowly now it seemed like the next one would be the very last.